Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio this day before we all vote. I voted early, though, for the first time in my whole darn life, because tomorrow's going to be busy and a late night. Today's busy as well. So some of us have waited until tomorrow, but we thought we would this hour concentrate on four states that we know will receive a whole lot of attention tomorrow. And we centered in on Florida, which is going to receive a whole lot of attention tomorrow, and Ohio, the first hour of the program. This hour of the show, we'll look at Pennsylvania and North Carolina, which is going to be figured prominently in tomorrow's discussion as well. And we'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, but both of them know what's going on in other places, too. So if you want to center on Nevada, if you want to look at what's happening in Wisconsin and Colorado, feel free to do that. We're welcoming phone calls for two new guests. We're going to give half hour to them. John Micek is with us, the first part of the hour, a longtime Capitol and politics reporter who authors the Capitol Ideas blog. He is currently the editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and for Penn Live. For more than a dozen years, he was the state government reporter for the Morning Call in Allenton, and his political reporting career has included four governors, 13 state budgets, and four presidential campaigns. And later in the hour, we'll speak with a professor of politics at Wake Forest University who closely follows U.S. and North Carolina political races. Our phone number for you to join the conversation, please leave messages on this day before, you know, our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you there. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. You can join us on the phone this hour, 800-486-8655. Send us messages, as Penny did. We didn't get to you last hour, Penny, but we will this hour. The Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter. Donald Trump is not, I understand, from the New York Times yesterday. And his campaign is much more messaged, isn't it? And our Twitter is at K Dunn Show. All right. So we thank you, John, very much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, Kathleen. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me aboard.
Yeah, thank you so much. You got a lot of parties going on in Pennsylvania today, John, huh?
You can't turn around without running into a candidate someplace in Pennsylvania today. Vice President Joe Biden was here in the state capital of Harrisburg on Sunday. Donald Trump was through on Friday in the town of Hershey, which is about a half an hour away from Harrisburg. President and Mrs. Obama are campaigning in Philadelphia this evening with Hillary Clinton and a couple, and this guy named Bruce Springsteen, whom your listeners might have heard of, will be along for the ride, we're let's understand as well.
Yeah. And so does that get people, I was thinking about this last hour, does that really get people motivated to vote to hear Bruce Springsteen?
It gets them motivated to go see Bruce Springsteen, I think.
Right.
But the people who are at, you know, Mrs. Clinton's rallies are there because, you know, they are all in for Hillary Clinton. I mean, at this point, Mrs. Clinton's probably +4, +5 in Pennsylvania, it looks like, based on the latest polling data.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, it's just making sure that she gets those people who are quite passionately out for her out to vote. And that's what this final push is all about.
John, how important was and what did you make of the latest Comey FBI letter to Congress yesterday?
Yeah, you gotta wonder why the complete head scratcher to begin with 9 days ago. We put up with 9 days of headlines.
Right.
Was she, wasn't she, and he comes out yesterday. And it's a grand embarrassment for the FBI. I know Director Comey is 3 years into a 10-year term, and everybody on social media was calling for his head on a lance on Sunday afternoon. It's a big black eye for the Bureau. It never seemed much more like political backside covering to begin with. It was not a great moment for American politics by any stretch.
Inside the Hillary Clinton campaign, there must be people who are pretty darn angry.
Oh, there absolutely are. We were hearing people who are completely enraged, who are completely livid over this late game announcement by Director Comey, and it turned out to be a big fat nothing burger. But what they got out of it, unfortunately, was, or from their perspective, in any event, was Donald Trump closing his margin both nationally and in Pennsylvania polls. Yeah.
The polls really have changed since that Access Hollywood tape came out, haven't they?
They have indeed.
Yeah. So you described in a piece that you wrote. What is today? The 7th. Today, as a matter of fact, you wrote this morning.
That's
less
right.
than 24 hours to go, and you wanted to provide us with a snapshot. You talk about the American voter in this election as one of the strangest, loudest, and most controversial campaign seasons in recent memory. We come stumbling into the final turn. Strange, loud, and controversial. How controversial?
Well, in Donald Trump, you have just a volcano of controversy, don't you, Kathleen? I mean, between the Access Hollywood tape, between his remarks about Mexicans, about Muslims, about everybody, I guess. I'm not sure there's a constituency left that Donald Trump has not found some way to offend at least once. And just being out there and talking to people and the great deal of uncertainty and apprehension, you hear honestly, on both sides. There are Trump supporters who are deathly afraid of what will happen if Mrs. Clinton prevails on Tuesday, and conversely, there are Clinton supporters who are deathly afraid of what will happen if Mr. Trump prevails on Tuesday. There is deep unease. You stand in these Donald Trump rallies, and it's clear that he is tapped into a vein of insecurity, of economic unease among a certain portion of the electorate who thinks that the economy in their country is being taken away from them. It's my fifth presidential cycle now, and it is by far one of the weirdest I think I've ever seen. I mean, we haven't gone more than 3 or 4 days without some sort of eruption or headline.
Yeah. Well, somebody took away his Twitter. It's made a world of difference, hasn't it? No, it has, I think.
You wonder where they were back in June of 2015, why they didn't just smash all of his cell phones and hit all of his computer keyboards. There's that great moment on Saturday Night Live on Saturday where Alec Baldwin, his Trump joke, that he communicated on a secret and totally secure communications network known as Twitter. And the anchor pointed out that the whole world could read this, and he deadpanned, "Then how am I still in this thing?" And it's exactly right for everything that Donald Trump has posted to Twitter.
Yeah,
it's been said over and over again. How has he not blown up his own candidacy? And yet, here we are.
Well, let's go to Wednesday. I know we can't really, but a couple questions. Do you expect any more major changes in this election in the next 24 hours? And the second question is a very serious one and a sobering one, I think, because we are so incredibly divided. If Trump loses, how do the supporters wake up on Wednesday? How do they carry forward? If Clinton loses, how do the Clinton supporters carry on Wednesday?
I will take your first question first. Right now, it looks like Hillary Clinton has, at least I'm concerning myself with Pennsylvania, it looks like she has Pennsylvania pretty well in the bag.
Does she?
It looks like it. No Republican has carried the state since George H.W. Bush in 1988. Donald Trump's path to victory here, it's not impossible, but it is certainly difficult. If you look at a map of Pennsylvania, you will see a profusion of red and these oases of Democratic blue, which is kind of misleading. With a strong showing in Philadelphia and its suburbs and Pittsburgh and its immediate suburbs, which is the greatest population density and which is overwhelmingly Democratic, that is a numerical advantage that will be very difficult for Mr. Trump to overcome. There is a path, perhaps through the Northeast in Scranton, the home of former Reagan Democrats who have sort of come over to his side, and maybe in the coal mining towns of the Southwest. But it is difficult at this late stage to envision a scenario where Mr. Trump can carry Pennsylvania. To your second point, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? What do we do on Wednesday morning when 40-some-odd% of the nation wakes up and finds out that their candidate has lost?
Right.
We've heard anecdotally from Trump supporters of somehow defying a putative Clinton administration, either through disobedience or through the tip tap of arms. And God forbid, I hope.
Oh, for heaven's
sake.
I
hope that it doesn't come to that.
I do too.
I can't even imagine what we would do. But, I mean, that goes, I think, Kathleen, to the very deep schisms between these two camps. You have, you know, the old joke that America and Great Britain were two countries separated by a common language, and I think you could probably say the same thing about the Trump and Clinton supporters, that they are all Americans but inhabit vastly different biospheres. And that great trick on Wednesday morning, that one thing we've always been able to do as a country on the day after the election is begin to slowly heal,
right,
looks like a far more difficult task this time around.
Well, it's kind of sad, isn't it? It's very sad.
It is. I mean, I'm a great fan of American politics. I'm a great fan of our system, and it pains me to be this negative. I do hope that it's something we can come out of.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Carrie in Milwaukee. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I don't like either candidate. I look at both of them with severe disdain. But given the fact that we have the pot calling the kettle black, I just, you know, Trump has bankrupted himself 4 times. He's divided the country. He feeds off a divisiveness and the slippery slope thing. Where does it all end?
John.
Where does it all end for Mr. Trump? Well, one way or the other, I guess we'll find out on Tuesday evening. But it's as I was saying earlier that he has tapped into this sort of sense of insecurity, of unease. And I do honestly, you know, having spoken with a lot of these voters down the last 15 months or so, it's not something that you can easily brush aside. You know, there's a sense of loss, a sense of trying to recover something. And I think, you know, if Mrs. Clinton does win on Tuesday, that she dismisses these people at her great peril. I mean, it is out there, and it's real. And something Bernie Sanders tapped into during the Democratic primary as well.
Yes, he did. You're right. Here's an interesting question from Barbara, who sends this email. I'd like to know, whoever loses, will the media turn off the lights on the loser and not let them to continue to rile things up after the election?
I think if it's Hillary Clinton, she will go gently into that good night, because I just think she's that sort of candidate. It would be nice to think that if Donald Trump loses, he could go back to, you know, Trump Tower and his gilded penthouse on Park Avenue there, and we wouldn't have to worry about him. But one suspects that Trump being Trump, that's not going to be the case. We keep hearing about him wanting to set up this Trump TV thing where he would have a network to rival Fox, or a government in absentia to harry Hillary Clinton for the next 4 years. But I would hope that we would only cover him when he says something newsworthy in that new capacity. If it's just simply some words falling out of his mouth, I hope we as a industry would not fall over him quite the way we have, or at least the way we did early on in his candidacy.
Oh,
media got wise to his shtick by the end.
He's received an incredible amount of attention. TV, cable news, good grief. Lots
of
it.
Absolutely. Yep.
Carrie, thanks for the call. Chris in Spooner.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Chris.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi. I'm calling today to tell you who I am. I voted a few days ago, and I voted for Hillary Clinton. So did my family. And before, we were at the very beginning when this election thing started, we were voting for Trump. But all this stuff I've been finding out about him, I can't see him as president. We need to have Hillary, you know. That's just my opinion, you know, but that's just the way I feel. And I feel like she'll make a good president, you know. And, this is such a very nerve-wracking time for everybody, you know, to be voting and stuff. And, so it's just,
Right. Gotcha, Chris.
You know,
all right.
Yeah,
but, thanks.
Yep. No
yeah.
problem.
Oh,
have a good day.
Thank you. Is that an unusual voter, John?
Yeah, somebody gets that guy's name and telephone number handed over to the Clinton campaign. I think they're going to want him knocking doors knocking doors for them for the next 16 hours or so. You know, one of the things that we did here, Kathleen, particularly here in Pennsylvania, was about the migration of Democratic voters over to the Republican side. About 90,000 in Pennsylvania, I think, at last count. And it's interesting when you get out there and you talk to people, this is what they wanted to bring up with your last caller. Is your ballot a vote for Hillary Clinton or a vote against Donald Trump? And a lot of the time, it's the latter rather than the former. And if you talk to Trump voters, it's not the same. It's not quite the same. They are affirmatively voting Donald Trump. So to see, you know, to hear about this gentleman say that he was on Team Trump and then jumped off and became Hillary, he is a rare bird indeed.
Thanks, Chris, very much for your call. Ruth in Milton. Hi, Ruth.
I want to say that I have an easy choice. Hillary would not accept the support of radical white supremacy groups, as her opponent has done. And then the company that Ron Johnson and Paul Ryan keep, I have to judge them by that they are keeping the company of this Republican candidate. So I am recommending that I cannot support them, and I will support Hillary wholeheartedly, Russ Feingold, and Ryan Solon, the Democrat, for this congressional district.
Thanks, Ruth, very much for your call. That brings us to Senate races. She mentioned the Feingold-Johnson race here in Wisconsin, which is darn close, according to the reputable Marquette Law School poll that came out last week. What are your thoughts, John, about the Senate, the U.S. Senate? Tell me about the race in Pennsylvania, and tell me where you think the Democrats can pick seats up and where they were expected to and might not.
Okay, I'm having a little trouble with the connection right now, Stephanie, but what I think you said is about close congressional races?
Senate races, yes.
Okay. Right now, Stephanie, the big race to watch is the U.S. Senate race between J.D. McGinty, the Democrat, and Republican Pat Toomey, who's the incumbent in that race.
Mm-hmm.
The polling average has been in the margin for most of the last couple of weeks. And it could really go either way. If there's a strong showing for Hillary Clinton in Philadelphia tomorrow, then it looks like it could very well be Mrs. McGinty's ballgame.
Hmm. So you think the chances are, what I'm hearing from most people in the last day or so, that it looks like 50-50 in the Senate, Democrats in the form of Tim Kaine would be tiebreakers. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, there's a decent chance, I think, that the Senate will flip, and the Pennsylvania seat will be right at the top of that list.
Right.
There's less in the U.S. House for Pennsylvania, very few competitive races, maybe one in Bucks County, which is just outside of Philadelphia, which went Democrat in 2006, but is very moderate and could well go Democrat this time out.
Hmm. Let's go next to Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
It was just a few short weeks ago that Republicans were running away from Donald Trump in droves after the excess Hollywood tapes. I guess that just speaks to the short attention span of the American voter. But I wanted to draw listeners' attention to the first segment from yesterday's This American Life that was on this station. It's a fascinating piece that looks at a political reporter's examination of the FBI investigation into the email controversy. And really, very few people have read the 240-some pages of reports on that investigation. And he kind of encapsulates it in a way that makes you see this from a totally different vantage point, makes you see that there were, despite the fact that Donald Trump over and over at the top of the hour on this NPR network continually talks about how she's the most corrupt candidate ever, it's probably more correct to say that she's the most technologically inept individual to ever occupy the Secretary of State's office, but maybe not so sinister and corrupt as Trump would have you believe. It's a fascinating mm-hmm. thing to listen to. It's about 25 minutes long. I would recommend it for anybody who is on the fence or anybody who wants a different look at the email controversy.
You know, thank you, Steve. You're about the fifth person who's told me about this, and that rarely happens in the last 10 hours or so. Have you had a chance to hear that? John?
No, I'm sorry. I'm just building on the connection. No, I've not heard that report. But, I mean, this is something that is really one of Hillary Clinton's basic challenges. I mean, there's a story by PolitiFact a few weeks ago that found that most of her statements on the campaign trail were something like 85% true, and that she is, in fact, more trustworthy than Donald Trump. But after 3 decades in public life, people have this nagging sense that she is somehow dishonest or corrupt. And even as she's been found, you know, exonerated in the Benghazi investigations, or Director Comey has finally, you know, decided that she hasn't done anything wrong with the email, it's not going to change people's minds. And this is her great challenge.
Yeah. Well, she probably, it could have behooved her to be a little bit more forthcoming about a number of issues as well, right? Healthcare in the 1990s and the emails, quite frankly.
But it was kind of stupid, frankly, how we lost 9 days talking about nothing about but the email.
Lot, yeah.
In fact, yes, there are all these grand policy questions that need to be debated.
Right. All right. Well, John, what are you paying close attention to on election night, North Carolina? And
I'm sorry, say again?
What will you be paying very close attention to tomorrow night?
I'll be watching Pennsylvania quite closely. We have Colorado in play, as you mentioned at the beginning of the segment. I'll be fascinated to see what happens in Arizona. That's traditionally Republican territory. But a possible Clinton pickup. It's not one that's likely. It's not one that she needs. But if she wins in Arizona, I think that sends a real message to Republicans that they have a problem.
Absolutely. Well, they do have a problem. Indications are even now they have a problem with Latina votes in this country.
That's true. You know, in North Carolina, they have that great gubernatorial race as well. Pat McCrory.
Right.
The author of the so-called bathroom law out there being challenged by the in general.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people working really, really hard to get rid of him, and a strong showing by Hillary Clinton in North Carolina could steal his state as well.
Well, and that's the state we go to next. Thank you very much, John, for being with us. John Micek, our guest for the first half hour of this show. He's a longtime Capital and Politics reporter. He's currently the editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live. And he has covered 4 governors, 13 state budgets, 4 presidential campaigns, and is on his fifth. We'll continue. We're looking at the states that everybody's going to be paying very close attention to tomorrow night. And we mentioned North Carolina. John mentioned it, and we have during this hour. We go to North Carolina for our next segment where there's all kinds of stuff going on. There's questions about whether or not there's been an attempt to keep African Americans from voting by purging the rolls. We've got an interesting governor's race in North Carolina and a crucial race for Donald Trump to win. So we'll look at all of that with our next guest and welcome more of your phone calls. The number here is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And now, with Professor John Dinan, professor of politics at Wake Forest University, who covers closely U.S. and North Carolina political races, teaches courses on campaigns, elections, state politics, Congress, and policy making. He provides commentary for the Associated Press, The Economist, The Charlotte Observer. He is the author of The American State Constitutional Tradition, and we thank him for joining us as our last commentator and in the all-important, probably one of the most, if not the most important state in tomorrow's election, everybody's going to be looking at, which is North Carolina. And John, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Well, the eyes and the ears of the nation are focused on you, sir. And your state tomorrow, right?
Oh, it's a big election, and we've got not only a big presidential election, but we have a governor's election, a Senate election. We've got the full trifecta.
Yeah, you sure do. Somebody called about the governor's election. Let me ask you about that. It's not only a battleground state and an important one in the race for president, but let's look at your gubernatorial race. North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, a Republican, very tight race against the Democratic challenger, Roy Cooper. Many are saying that it's more of a referendum on the state's bathroom bill, the law considered harmful to the LGBTQ community, and it has cost the state millions of dollars. So that's why some people are deciding to vote against the governor. How big is this issue? Will that issue determine the governor's race?
Yeah, that's been a very prominent issue. In fact, one would say that the Democratic challenger, Roy Cooper, that's been one of the most prominent issues. If you look at Cooper advertising, if you look at Cooper campaign rallies, the state's bathroom law has featured very saliently. That being said, Governor McCrory has sought to turn the attention elsewhere, sought to put the attention on the economy, on other matters. It's been a very salient issue.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we're hearing bits and pieces of, I wonder who's doing the investigation here. What about the purging of voter rolls? Are African Americans underrepresented in a large way because of that in North Carolina? Do we know?
Yeah. You know, there's been a lot of attention focused on North Carolina in terms of voting elections laws. We should say that North Carolina several years passed a major elections bill that would reduce the number of days of early voting. It would eliminate opportunities for same-day registration. It would have required voter ID. All of those provisions of the law were invalidated by a federal appellate court, and so none of those are in place. That is, the same days of early voting are now back in place. Voter ID is not required, and same-day registration is permissible during the early voting period. So in that respect, one wouldn't expect to see an effect on voting turnout from those particular provisions, given that they're all reinstated at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. What about what we've been hearing about purging of rolls that people who had been on, not voted for the last couple of elections,
yeah,
whose names were not on the rolls anymore?
Yes, no. That in that particular issue, that's been the most recent issue that's come to the fore. Sometimes it's difficult to keep track of all the elections-related lawsuits that are going through. But yes, that's the most recent one. And here the issue is that the state had provisions for if you have mailing sent to voters on the voter rolls and they come back as undeliverable several times, you had several counties in the state that were then removing people from the voting rolls. But that conflicts with federal statute, which says that you can't be taking those steps within 90 days of an election. And so a federal judge said that those people in those three counties that had been acting aggressively and within the 90-day period must restore those people to the voting rolls. So that's significant, but it should be noted that that's confined to the three counties where this behavior has taken place and has less of a statewide effect.
I see. Do you have more registered Democrats or more registered Republicans in the state of North Carolina?
There's significantly more registered Democrats in the state.
Are there?
For a long time, North Carolina was a Democratic state. It was a one-party Democratic state. And that's still reflected in the significant advantage of registered Democrats in the state. Registered Republicans have been kind of slowly pulling up, but still far behind. The real surge that we've been seeing in this particular in the last 4 years has been a surge of unaffiliated voters, that is, voters registering not as Republicans or Democrats. Those numbers are very significant, and when we look at early voting totals in North Carolina, that early voting totals among unaffiliated voters surged over 40% from 2012 to 2016.
Wow, why is that?
You know, in part it's because more and more people have been registering as unaffiliated. People moving into the state, a lot of in-migration into North Carolina, a number of younger voters who are declining to associate with one of the parties. And it's also the case in North Carolina, they have a primary rules where if you're an unaffiliated voter, you can take either a Republican or Democratic primary ballot in the nomination. So that's in some ways advantageous. For whatever reason, there's been more and more people over the last 4 years registering as unaffiliated, and that's very much reflected in the early voting totals. North Carolina keeps very good data on the early voting gathering who's voting early, unaffiliated by party, by race, by youth. That's the top line story coming up from early voting, is a surge of unaffiliated.
Interesting. And what are you seeing in terms of ground game in North Carolina? We've heard in other states the Democrats appear to have the advantage, and the Republicans seem to be not as together with their normally wonderful turnout operation as they have been in previous years. You think that's true in North Carolina or not?
Yeah, I would say that story is consistent in North Carolina, just as in other states. One way of seeing that is we usually think of running a presidential campaign as having three-legged stool. You have a strong ground game, you have a strong air game in terms of going up on TV ads, and then you make a lot of campaign visits and hold rallies. Well, the Clinton campaign has been running solid on all three of those legs. The Trump campaign has really, until recently, has just been doing a lot of rallies. They have only recently started adding campaign ads, and their ground game, it's still very uncertain how strong they are there, but it'd be very difficult for them to make up the ground that the Clinton campaign enjoys in that regard.
And is that because he's a controversial person inside the Republican Party that people are reluctant to give support, so they're not rallying around him, or what is it?
Well, in part, it's just that the whole Trump campaign has been run in a different way than previous campaigns. And Trump has said, well, I have all these advisors that advise me to be, getting people on ground game, but I'm going to run my campaign and in my own way, and that means I like going to the rallies. That's been the dominant part of his campaign feature, and the Republican Party has been helping out in recent times with the ground game and that sense, but it has not been Trump putting the focus there.
Yeah. How important is North Carolina? Does he have to win North Carolina and Florida? Could he just get by with winning North Carolina and he's on his way?
You know, we've long said during this whole race that it'd be very difficult to envision a path for Trump to get to victory of 270 electoral votes without North Carolina. I still maintain that that's the case, that Trump would. It's easy to see Hillary Clinton getting to 270 electoral votes without North Carolina, but it's very difficult to see Trump doing that. I still maintain that's the case. Are there other ways? Could he make up for North Carolina by some Rust Belt or Midwest states? Perhaps, but it's very difficult.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We move to North Carolina for our final analysis after being in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida. John Dinan is a professor of politics at Wake Forest University, teaches courses on campaigns and elections, state politics, Congress, and policymaking. He writes frequently for the AP, The Economist, The Charlotte Observer, and other outlets around the country. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're obviously interested in what's going on with the Clinton-Trump race, but also the gubernatorial race in the state of North Carolina, which is, essentially almost dead even at this point, and it's an interesting race. We're talking about that. But he's a professor of politics, so he can talk about what's going on all over the place. Your phone calls are welcome. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Make sure you join us tomorrow on Election Day. We'll be checking in with WPR reporters stationed around the state to find out what turnout is like, if there are any problems at any of the polls, be they Green Bay or Madison or Superior or La Crosse, Milwaukee. At 7 o'clock, Wisconsin Public Radio will provide live coverage of state and national races. At 10 o'clock, National Public Radio reporters will continue live election night coverage. And then Wednesday, It's over. We'll have post-election coverage, and we'll have great analysts with us on Wednesday for the full 2 hours. All right, let's go to phone calls. Mark, traveling through the state. Hi, Mark.
Hey, hi, Kathy. Just a quick comment. All I see, I'm a truck driver. All I see are signs for Trump and Pence in about 11 states around the Midwest that I travel every week. So what does that mean?
What does that mean, Professor?
Well, here's what I would say, is it all depends on where you're traveling. The one thing that we know is that voters in urban areas are leaning strongly Democratic and strongly for Hillary Clinton's campaign. Voters in more rural areas are leaning, in some cases, just as strongly for Trump and for Republicans. And so it really matters as much as anything, not just which states you're driving through, but what parts of those states that you're driving through. That's been a rather constant in American politics for recent decades, of a bifurcated support, depending on urban, rural, with suburban areas being kind of the battleground. So that could account for some of what you see there.
Mm-hmm. So you can't really look at signs and determine overall who's voting.
Yeah, that's the challenge here, is that we often, sometimes people say, well, I'm seeing the Trump rallies, I'm seeing the Clinton rallies, and they're trying to figure out, well, who do I see more people at which rallies? Was that kind of extrapolate for voting? I see more yard signs here. And yes, we make lessons, we draw insights from that. But at the end of the day, it's difficult to draw too much from that in terms of expecting or predicting vote totals.
Yeah. Our number, 800-486-8655. A question from Sydney on Facebook. How many people do you expect, and how many in recent presidential elections, what percentage of Americans actually vote? And how does that affect our government? And what do you anticipate? What would be a great number? You'd say, oh, a lot of people voted, this is great. How many actually do, and why?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. In some ways, you have to break this down in terms of what we're counting as a voter turnout percentage. And here it makes a difference. Are we counting voter turnout as a percentage of all people in the country above the age of 18? That would give us one number. Or are we talking about how many people are voting as a percentage of all people who are eligible to vote above the age of 18, which would take account of people who are disfranchised because of felony conviction or non-citizen status? That being said, a rough number, a way to look at it, is about 58%, maybe 60% of the people will turn out to vote in the 2016 election. That number is down from where it was as recently as the 1960 election. The 1960 election, we were more along the lines of 64-65% voter turnout. That's been the high watermark in recent years. And of course, Americans look abroad and they see some other countries where voter turnout rates are in the 80% range, or in some cases even the 90% range. And so America's an outlier in that regard, in only having about 60% of people turn out to vote.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark, for your call, and thanks, Sydney, for your comment on Facebook. Tom in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. I'm discussion about how close the race based on polls mainly, and I'm wondering if there might be a surprise, as there was in England with Brexit.
Okay, good question.
Yeah, what to say? Polling is a science, but it's also an art. And the biggest challenge, if I would have to say, is how do you model, going on our last question, how do you model what the turnout would be? Because we can talk to people and you interview 100 people, but then you have the next figure out which of those 100 people will actually turn out to vote in the poll. And so a lot of the challenges that pollsters face is making predictions, or as we say, models about what the turnout will be. Will turnout be similar to what it was in 2012? Will it be lower than it was in 2012 because people might be turned off by a nasty campaign? Will it be higher than it was in 2012 because people will be stimulated by seeing a lot of ads? And that's the biggest challenge of trying to get these polls just right. And when you see different polls coming in, oftentimes that's because you have different models or predictions about turnout. It's a very inexact science.
Professor Dynan, what's your analysis of the early voting?
Yeah. In terms of early voting, that says, North Carolina is one of the states which we now have 17 days of early voting. That is 17 days out from the election. You can begin voting. North Carolina, judging from history, over half of the vote in North Carolina will be cast in the early voting
period,
even before the day begins. And in fact, this year we have a record. Over 3 million votes have already been cast in the early voting period. And so people are already trying to discern some lessons and some insights into what those early voting totals show. But the main point is that Election Day, will actually a minority of people in North Carolina will vote on Election Day. The vast majority of them will have voted pre-Election Day.
Hmm. It's quite a change. Tom, thanks for the call. Lori in Madison, hi.
Hey, Kathleen. Speaking of early voting in North Carolina, the North Carolina GOP put out a press release just yesterday afternoon in which they struck a happy tone about the fact that African American early voting was down this year. They actually said, I can't read exactly, the title of the email they sent out was North Carolina Obama Coalition Crumbling. And they said that African American early voting was down 8.5% from this time in 2012. And they said happily that Caucasian voters' early voting is up 22.5%. And, you know, all those efforts on the part of the Republican GOP in North Carolina to eliminate early voting and other modes of going to the polls that would directly affect African Americans, those things, some of those were still in effect this year. And there's a lot of talk that this decrease in voting, because African American voting is up in other southern states this year so far. But anyway, I think this is sad.
Thanks, Lori. Is it up in other states, though? We just did Florida, and African American voting is down in Florida as well. What do you have on that?
No, that's right. When we look at some of these early voting totals around the country, and the one thing that's stood out from a number of states is the surge in Hispanic participation in early voting. But if we look at North Carolina, we look to some degree at Florida, there is no doubt that African-American participation in early voting is not as high in 2016 as it was in 2012. Now, if you talk to Democratic strategists and analysts, they say, look, we never thought it was going to be as high in 2016. It was going to be in 2012 and 2008, where President Obama was on the ballot, but we wanted it to be as close as possible to there. It's tough to say whether it's close enough, that is, to carry Hillary Clinton to victory, but there's no doubt that African Americans make up 22% of the North Carolina population, and so there's good reason why people are paying a lot of attention to African American participation in early voting turnout. It has not been as vigorous as it was in previous elections. It hasn't been down that much, but it has been down. But that's one of the things that Hillary Clinton is returning to North Carolina tonight in Raleigh with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is also coming to Greensboro, North Carolina. And so there's some real turnout efforts to kind of boost some of the supporters for Democratic candidates, that early voting shows some slightly worrisome signs so far.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we have lines open if you'd like to speak with Professor John Dinan, professor of politics, Wake Forest University. Writes for the Associated Press, providing commentary, The Economist, Charlotte Observer, and all kinds of news outlets all around the country. We'd love to hear from you as we get ready to vote, or maybe you've already voted. We are focusing the last couple hours on the states that are very important to the outcome of the presidential election, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, and move the conversation in other directions if you'd like. We just would love to hear from you, 800-486-8655. Many of our commentators today and during the last year and a half we've been covering this race, it's been way too long, talk about how particularly vicious this campaign has been and some of the inflammatory rhetoric that's been used. And people worry about what's going to happen on Wednesday, what will happen on Wednesday. In order for tensions to be eased, what do both people need to say after somebody has declared the winner tomorrow night? Professor?
No, that's a very important issue to be focusing on. There's no doubt that the campaign appeals, the campaign ads have been particularly negative this year. That is, they have been focused on what the candidates themselves can bring to the table in terms of policies. They've been focused on defects or potential flaws in the other candidate. And so we're already in a polarized era. That is, the statistics are increasingly showing that people just have a difficult time relating to people across the political aisle. And that's come out more than ever in this election. How does that come back together? Well, we do have some rituals in this country, and the standard ritual is that once the election, once we get a clear outcome, the losing candidate would then concede the election. That becomes the start of the healing process by which the candidate supporters, it's not easy to do that, but the candidate supporters then start to see their opponents not so much as political enemies, but as political opponents who they might then sit across the table from. That's what we'll be watching very carefully for. Sometimes it happens on the election night itself, Tuesday night, but sometimes, as in 2004 election, it was still the next day, the Wednesday, that John Kerry actually gave a speech of that kind after losing to George W. Bush. So if it's the night of, or even the next day, hopefully soon after there, that starts to begin the healing process. It will be a difficult one.
Yeah. You know, and we've been listening to today the announcement that Hillary Clinton was entering the race, to Donald Trump entering the race. For heaven's sake, in the middle of June of 2015, this is a bit too long, don't you think?
Yeah. You know, it's one of the things when we talk about observers from other countries and how they respond to or react to American elections. And we've already talked about how they're struck by the low voter turnout in American elections. They're used to having much higher turnout, and they say, why is it that American voter turnout is low? But the next thing they say, or right up there, is they say, how do you have such long elections, and what's the consequence of that? And part of the idea there is that when you have elections that come on fixed dates, as you do in the United States, system, people just start beginning and preparing for that earlier and earlier. In some other countries, they don't even call, they just call elections and they say, okay, here's going to be a 6-week period and we're going to contest the elections. Well, that's not possible in the U.S. And as the more, it's not just that the general election kind of takes longer, but then people spend even more time getting prepared for the primaries and to kind of.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. It's too much. Will you be very relieved it's over on Wednesday, or will you miss it?
Well, it's been fascinating. I don't think we've seen an election cycle like this before. A complete outsider in Donald Trump, who very few people thought was going to win the nomination and does win the nomination. A general election, which at various times over the last few months seemed like it might not be a closely contested election, but then at other times it starts moving forward and seeing more closely contested. So that's been it's been exciting. I am ready for it to be over, that I'm ready for attention to turn to the task of governance. That is, so much of our attention is rightly focused on elections. It's exciting. It brings us all together to focus on these. But as important, or perhaps more important than elections, is what happens after the elections. How does governance take place on important issues such as environment, education, other matters? I'll be waiting for attention to turn to those directions.
Let's go to Roberta in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Roberta.
Hello. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the when I turned to watch the Republican convention, how horrible they sounded and talked, and it was very shocking.
Yeah. You know, the conventions themselves, that it used to be times of drama. You really didn't even know who would actually emerge as the nominee. But since the 1950s, everything is decided on one ballot. There have been these multiple ballots that have passed. So now it's a chance. How do you get your message out, and what do you want to focus on? Some of that message is, what do I want to put out positively about my program? But increasingly, it's an opportunity. How do I point out flaws in my opponent? And so a number of people probably focused on the conventions as they move more in that latter direction of focusing on critiques of the other side as much as focusing on positives. That, in some ways, they can be said to be a product of our polarized situation. When the people ask, they say, well, why are you a Republican? And I say, why are you a Democrat? Turns out the number one reason that people give for why they're Republican, because they dislike Democratic policies. And for Democrats, the dislike of Republican policies ranks almost right up there alongside of, I like my own party's policies. Well, if that's the worldview that people have, then you appeal to people increasingly by showing what's wrong with the other side. If that's what's motivating people, perhaps it's not surprising that our campaign has become so negative.
Let's go outside North Carolina for just a moment. We're almost out of time. What other states are particularly intriguing to you right now, Professor Dunn?
Well, I'm particularly intrigued by North Carolina. At one point, had a lot of ticket splitting. That is, there was a time from the 1990s to the early 2000s where four straight elections, North Carolinians voted Republican for president and Democratic for governor. Same election. They'd be splitting their tickets. There's still a little bit of that ticket splitting, but increasingly it's straight party balloting. And so I'll be interested to see. We have three big races, as we said, the presidential race, the governor's race, and a hotly contested Senate race that could determine control. Will those races all move in the same direction, or might there be some ticket splitting and different outcomes?
Yeah, well, now we'll check on that. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Professor John Dinan, professor of politics at Wake Forest University, and we thank him. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour. Thanks to Zeb Gozman, and thanks to Scotty Myers, too. They've all been very busy during this election season. Lots of guests, lots of attention to detail to get all of this going, and it ain't over yet, right? Tomorrow we'll talk about immigration, the first hour of our program, and we'll check in with WPR reporters to see what's happening on Election Day. It's mañana all over the state. Thank you for listening.